Blog Talk Radio.
Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
Constitution Hour, brought to you by Patriot Families. That's patriotfamilies.com, Patriot Families with a Y-S. And I hope everybody enjoyed that intro song. That is Revolution by Poker Face. Just a little more upbeat, kind of more modern protest music. And I really enjoy some of their stuff. Tonight, I wanted to talk about the dreaded game of politics, but not in the general theme, more in the theme of why do we have a president and what is the president's role in our Constitution? You know, a lot of people may not realize this, but there was a lot of debate at the Constitutional Convention as to whether or not there should even be an executive, a chief executive. And once they had decided that there should be, there was even more debate over what the position should be called. one of the things that led to the idea of having a president or a chief executive, if you will, was the behavior of the various state legislatures prior to and during and after the Revolutionary War. Many of the state legislatures after the war was over, well, let's say they were not very kind to their constituents. They ran roughshod over many of them, some of them instituting taxes that were two and three times the level that the crown had imposed upon them. And people recognized that there had to be a way to kind of temper that system that was in place without necessarily diminishing the state, as it were. Yeah, exactly. Legislators run amok, based on most of the historical accounts. And, of course, the new federal government was going to be comprised of various legislators from the states. And the founders feared, quite rightly, that these same individuals, given the power of a federal government, would be more tyrannical than the monarch they had just thrown off. So they had decided on an executive position. So we have to ask ourselves, what was the purpose of the executive position? And the founders reasoned that an executive with the power to veto the legislation presented by Congress would be a constitutional check on the legislature, a means of keeping them within the boundaries and the reality of the Constitution. Now, of course, they could override his veto with a two-thirds majority vote. However, that still didn't ensure that an unconstitutional law would stand, because we had the Supreme Court and the various state courts that could strike down one of those laws. And, you know, we have to wonder, when we read the Constitution, we don't even, and I want to read you this part, because I think it's very important in explaining the role of president today versus what it was originally. Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. You know, I don't see the president mentioned there at all. All of the authority legislatively lays with the Congress. And I would propose, ladies and gentlemen, that all of these signing statements, executive orders, and so forth, when they carry the force and effect of law, are actually in violation of the Constitution. And we don't get to any mention of the president until, wow, you know, some several pages later in the document, where we find in Article 2, the executive power. And then, of course, it lays out how the executive is elected. And I think it is important to read this section. I'll try not to bore you all to death. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows. Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state is entitled in Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. We've bypassed that, but the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list of all persons voted for and the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate, or the sitting Vice President at that time. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the President. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when is the last time you saw such a ceremony take place? I don't recall it in my lifetime. I recall the fiasco down in Florida with all the hanging chads and the nonsense, the purely theatrical undertaking that went on. And this is why, and I know everyone has heard this a million times, but this is why I tell you that your vote does not elect the President of the United States. And it is important to understand that while the popular vote may well influence the Electoral College, the electors, I think it's well established that that's not necessarily the case. There are a couple of amendments to our Constitution that diminished that particular article, which was Article 1, Section 2. Excuse me. The 12th Amendment, which was ratified in 1804, changed things a little bit, and they did so because voting for two people at the time seemed a way for state electors to cast two votes for president for two people or for one person. So they changed that, and they were on a distinctly different ballot. They had one vote for president, one vote for vice president. So this is when we got the split, because the way it used to be prior to 1804 is whoever came in second was the vice president, and evidently that wasn't working out so well. Nonetheless, it remains much the same, the rest of the language. And I think it's important to recognize that it is the Electoral College, and a sitting senator or representative or federal employee is not allowed to vote as an elector. Now, we did go through a stage where we passed another amendment, which kind of, well, not kind of, it does piss me off. And that is the amendment that allows the District of Columbia to have and appoint electors as if they were a state. And I think that that should be repealed, along with the 17th Amendment that allows senators to be elected by popular vote. Both of those things are detrimental to the health and well-being of a republic, a constitutional republic. But, nonetheless, the role of the president was much like it was long time, when we look at George Washington and his attendance at the Constitutional Convention, Washington, in fact, said almost nothing during the entire convention. He didn't have to, and he knew that he didn't have to. Now, there was a guy that worked very diligently trying to persuade Washington to make a public appearance. And he was working really, really hard at it because he knew that the only way that this was going to get resolved would be for George Washington himself to show up in the flesh, to put down what was a very serious threat to our fledgling country. And what had happened is, you know, and a lot of people don't know this, but after the Revolutionary War, there was a problem where a lot of the soldiers were not being paid, the veterans. And these veterans got together and they were about to create an insurrection, an armed insurrection, right here in the good old United States of America. And it was pretty bad. Imagine having fought and bled for your state, for your freedom, and being injured or worse, disabled in your service, and then not being compensated as you were supposed to be. So these guys were literally ready to riot. Now, there was a lot more behind the uprising than just simply the fact that they weren't being paid. There was also a problem with their states. Many of these people had money in bonds, state bonds, that were devalued by their state governments. And so they were left almost destitute. Meanwhile, many of the states, as I mentioned earlier, actually had instituted enormous taxation on landholders, and many of these gentlemen were, of course, farmers, and they held a lot of land simply because that's what farmers do. And so they were in a paradox where their country, their state, was stealing from them through taxation their property, their land. And finally, when Washington was apprised of exactly how bad the situation was, and I forget the gentleman's name, forgive me because I am terrible with names, but finally, Washington acquiesced and said, okay, I'll come up there and talk to him, because he felt a sense of obligation and loyalty to his former troops, some of whom served directly under Washington. And so he went up and attended this meeting, and it is said that when Washington walked in the room full of ex-military officers and current military officers, they were stunned. They were shocked at his presence. And as he fumbled for his glasses and he asked their leave to forgive him that in his old age he had become practically blind, he read a very short prepared speech, and it was said that many of them wept openly. They had such a tremendous respect for Washington, his integrity was unquestionable. He didn't chastise them. He simply reiterated that what they were about to undertake would tarnish forever the very freedom they had fought so valiantly to secure. And that was the end of that uprising. That really illustrates what the role of the president was. Now, of course, see, they were trying to get Washington to go and join this club, and it's crazy. But Washington had set the standard. He set the bar, and he set it extremely high. There was no limit on how many terms a president could serve. Washington certainly had the whole world at his beck and call, should he desire it. He could have been our first president for life, but he chose two terms and left after his second term. He showed more integrity in his little finger than just about every president that has come since him. But when we contrast that to today and the role that the president takes on today, we see the problem staring us straight in the face. And I see everyone in the chat room talking about the movie by Dinesh D'Souza, 2016. That movie is actually a prime example of what we're talking about today. The president has been exonerated, lifted up to superstar status, and a status that is not deserved, nor is it a status that was ever granted through our Constitution, the law. But it shows the level to which the presidency has been bastardized and the level to which Congress has been effectively neutered. And I think that's why it's important that we have the right people in our Congress. And I have Mr. Robert on the phone with me. How are you, Robert?
Uncle Ron. Speaking of 2016, I'm doing fine. I saw it last night. It was very powerful. Very powerful movie.
I thought it was, I haven't seen it, but I've read a few things about it. And the one thing that I gather from the reviews, and I sent the article to Linda today, is that from an economic standpoint, it seems to be a whitewash.
Basically, it is a whitewash. It's the reason why you're right. I mean, there are certain parts I know Linda saw, and if she recalls the part where he visits his father's grave in Africa, you know, he was trying to fill in the circle of what his purpose was because he had an absent father most of his life, you know.
His absent father is the one that played the largest role in the shaping of his ideology. With the assistance and insistence of his mother. One of the points I made about this movie, and again, I haven't gone to see it, and I'll wait until it comes out on television to watch it, because quite honestly, there's nothing in that movie that I don't already know about Barack Obama, unless it's some little endearing story to really make you hate the guy. But I don't need all that. I had... All I needed to know about Obama long ago. I knew it in 2007, I knew it in 2008, and I still know it to this day. Part of the problem I have with the movie, and again, I can't really critique it on my own because I haven't seen it, but as Linda put up, the Mises Institute had a great article on this today that I forwarded to her, and the author of the article did see the movie, and he said one consistent theme throughout the movie is not recognizing the role of the previous administration or, and more importantly, the Congress themselves as the fundamental problem with Barack Obama's ideology and his economic policy, which, I mean, if you really boil it down, and if folks are truly honest with themselves, I would like you to point out to me, aside from Obamacare, which was Nancy Pelosi more than anyone driving that, aside from that, can you name me one of Obama's policies that is not an extension of Bush's policies?
I don't think so, no.
With perhaps cap and trade now is not one of Obama's policies because it never has passed the Senate and the House. That is certainly a progressive ideology, no doubt, and I wouldn't hang cap and trade all on Obama's shoulders because I think there's several members of the House and the Senate that would love to see cap and trade passed, but they know they don't have the votes.
They voted on that right after Obama's election, and it failed in the House. And
precisely.
since that time, the EPA has followed in Obama's footsteps. With if they can't legislate it, they're going to regulate it.
And who do we have on the phone with us?
I'm Richard Gates.
Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you.
Yeah, there is a lot of that goes on, unfortunately, in our political world. You know, we get it from all sides. Not only are we lambasted by the judiciary that just loves to legislate from the bench, whether it's a district or circuit court all the way up to the Supreme Court, but we also have a virtual cornucopia of bureaucrats that just love to read between the lines, you know, the tea leaves, as it were, and institute regulations based on some grandiose reading of the actual law itself.
Absolutely. And if you look back at some of Thomas Jefferson's writings, you'll find that he said that we should avoid that and that we should go back to the actual text and the debates that led to the text of our Constitution before making decisions on what is constitutional or not. And since we've migrated from case law to this rumor mill where we actually take on, what were the other cases that came before it, and we base a decision of law on a similar case, and it's just kind of the rumor mill expanded to the legal system.
Well, right, and that's known as stare decisis, which is precedence.
Yes.
And the first case that set precedence for the Supreme Court to actually determine the constitutionality of any law was Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah.
And the court took upon itself the moniker of constitutional determiner. And quite ironically, the Chief Justice at that time was a relative of Mr. Marbury, who consequently lost his case. But nonetheless, you know, I have a friend who is a lawyer. I will not call him an attorney. He has been instrumental in fighting these idiots and especially instrumental in fighting the Internal Revenue Service. He's routinely been sanctioned by the courts for bringing a frivolous argument. And for those of you that don't understand the term in legal speak, frivolous does not mean that it is an argument that is just ridiculous and could not be considered. It simply means that it is an argument that the court has determined, based on case precedents, has already been overruled and therefore can't be brought as a defense.
Yep.
Even though they may not have looked at every aspect, and you know every single case is different, but nonetheless, they go on this stare decisis. But he has a question, and the question that and he told me, and he's kind of keeping it under his hat, waiting for the appropriate time to bring a suit that will be in the Supreme Court. And that question is, where in our Constitution was our Congress given the authority to legislate by code or statute?
I'd like to know the answer to that question.
Well, they weren't, okay? And the point is that they were given the authority to pass all necessary and proper laws to carry out their function. But it's the way that we put these laws together. And what I mean is that we have a title code, Title 1 through 50. And for each title code, there is a corresponding Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR. So Congress passes a law, the codifiers, the law firm that's been hired by Congress to do this, they transcribe all that law into different titles, and then it's put into the books as law. At that moment in time is when a problem arises. The head of the agency will use Title 26, which is the tax code. The head of the agency, the Secretary of Treasury, Tim Geithner, is then empowered to write the corresponding regulations to implement said law. So you have, in effect, a bureaucrat writing law. If he reads it to mean one thing and Congress meant it to mean something else, it doesn't matter, because whatever the secretary writes down as the regulation, that is what is controlling. Now, certainly they go back to the law, and there has been some issues there, but that's how you end up with bureaucrats, like the gentleman was talking about under the EPA, writing law through the regulations under the title in which they're entitled to regulate.
Yep. Now let me ask you a question, because
yes,
I see that the 17th Amendment has been a huge flaw in our ability to maintain state integrity and sovereignty.
Absolutely, it has. Absolutely, it has. And I believe it should be repealed, along
the
with
wrong.
The 16th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and a few others.
Yeah, we can go on all night about that. The 17th Amendment, it took away the state's voice in federal government. And that was one of the things I think our founders were most concerned about, was state sovereignty.
Well, certainly, it's no accident that it came after the 14th Amendment. I mean, you know, basically, if you go back and look in history, and I've done a couple, two or three shows on this, Abraham Lincoln was without a doubt the worst president this country has ever had in terms of the Constitution and his stated goal of preserving the Union. He did anything but preserve the Union. He utterly destroyed it.
Well, he suspended habeas corpus.
Well, he did a hell of a lot more than suspend habeas corpus. He suspended habeas corpus. He instituted the Lieber Code in 1863, which was martial law. He imprisoned many people in the North who were newspaper editors and writers for writing articles that were in disagreement with the president's policy or unflattering to him. He sent an entire army division to the state of Maryland to sequester their state legislature so that they couldn't vote against him, and had them arrested. He had one politician, a representative from Ohio, deported from the country because he spoke ill of Mr. Lincoln on numerous occasions. He had Francis Scott Key's grandson held in military detention at Fort McHenry, ironically enough, for 2.5 years because he wrote an unflattering article. He demolished the Union. What came after the war, known as the Reconstruction Era, is when we had the first voter registration laws enacted, and that was only possible because the southern states were actually at that time considered military districts under military law and military rule. So this set up the system that we have today is directly traceable back to Abraham Lincoln. No question in my mind. And you have to ask yourself, you know, if it wasn't possible for the southern states to secede from the Union, then why did they have to go through, number one, elections and reelect their state governments and their state legislatures? They were not allowed to elect anyone who had given aid and support to the insurrection. So, of course, they had a lot of military men from the North being elected as governors and mayors and state legislators. And then once they convened their kangaroo state legislatures, they had to, as a condition of admission back into the Union, vote in favor of ratifying the 14th Amendment. And how could they ratify an amendment if they weren't a state?
You know what? It would be very helpful if you could post some of that and some references for research, because I'm sure a lot of us have never heard some of this stuff.
I've got a great link to, I believe it is Yale, where they have the Lieber Code. There's actually a great professor there. There's a whole series on the Civil War era. And imagine my amazement as I'm sitting through this Yale University class. It's a video class. And I heard this professor say something that I thought I was probably the only one in the United States of America that held that belief, and that is that under Lincoln, the old Union was dead and a new Union was created, a new United States. And that new United States began with the 13th Amendment. And, you know, I would encourage everyone to go look up the state of West Virginia and see how that came to be, because it was Virginia. You'll all remember one of the original 13 states was Virginia.
Sure.
It was by executive order that Lincoln divided the state of Virginia, and that's how we got West Virginia.
Learn something every day.
Yes, sir. So I think people need to brush up on that, because we're given this revisionist history of all these presidents. And I'm currently reading a book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Presidents. And as the author states in there, we have this problem of time grading presidents. And what he means is that their grade seems to increase with time. And of course, we have a shrine dedicated, a temple actually, dedicated to Abraham Lincoln in Washington, D.C. I was reprimanded by my stepmother. She said, it's not a temple. And I said, well, read what it says up there on the wall, because it starts out with this temple. And hey, you know, I think that just tells you about all you need to know, right?
It says a lot.
It certainly does.
But does it speak to Lincoln or the historians or the people who built that monument?
Well, I think it speaks to the people that built the monument and trying to present the legacy of Lincoln in the light of a demigod. And I put a link up there that is it's called the Avalon Project, Project Avalon at Yale University. That actually has some fascinating documents. If you go up to the top, they have documents dating back to 4000 BCE. You can actually go through the Code of Hammurabi and many others, ancient Roman legal documents and code. So it's pretty interesting.
Okay, but, well, that'd be great. And I hope you don't feel bad about this, but I am very leery about anything coming out of a university these days.
Oh, I don't blame you at all. But understand that this Project Avalon, these documents are literally, they're documents. It's not one person's opinion or another person's opinion, like the Lieber Code. It is quite literally just a reprinting of the actual code. If you click on that link, military law, martial law, military jurisdiction, military necessity and retaliation. Article 1, a place, district, or country occupied by an enemy stands in consequence of the occupation under the martial law of the invading or occupying army. Whether any proclamation declaring martial law or any public warning to the inhabitants has been issued or not, martial law is the immediate and direct effect and consequence of occupation or conquest. Okay, the southern states, we understand, were defeated by the Northern Union Army in a military conquest. And this goes on to say the presence of a hostile army claims its martial law. This is might makes right. No question about it. Many people don't even realize that Abraham Lincoln went into the Civil War without any congressional approval whatsoever. Congress did not approve of this. Lincoln claimed he was exercising the authority for the executive to put down a rebellion or an insurrection. Well, it wasn't a rebellion, and it wasn't an insurrection, because they simply left. They said, you guys do whatever you want. We're not taking part of it anymore.
Well, when...
when they fired on Fort Sumter?
I would have a little bit of a problem with that, because I would think that a nation has to defend its borders, its sovereignty as a nation as a whole.
Well, see, that's the thing. Hold on. Let's back up a minute.
Okay.
The founding fathers did not create a national government, and they didn't create a nation. They created a federal government. There is a distinct difference. But you're right. What Lincoln did was create a national government and created a nation. If you've ever watched the Civil War series by Ken Burns, there is a historian on there named Shelby Foote. Real nice fella. He's got a real southern draw. And Mr. Shelby Foote made an observation that I think speaks volumes. He said the one thing that the Civil War did is prior to the war, the people said the United States are. And after the war, without any prompting, the people said the United States is. And that is deafening, because what that war did, he's exactly correct in his observation, is that it demolished states' rights, independent sovereign states, and created a national government, a new United States.
And that was a lot of what federalism was about. Because we had, right after the Declaration of Independence, we had a very loose confederacy, and the president couldn't even, the federal government could not even tax. They had to go beg from the states.
Well, right.
So we came up with the Constitution, which formed a stronger central government.
Certainly.
It was a little bit right of center, but it was based on a federal government that had to have certain authority.
Correct. And that federal government was granted specific enumerated powers, and only those specific and enumerated powers. And much as they despised the idea, they knew that one of the powers, the chief power that they had to grant, was the taxing authority. And they did so with great trepidation. There is also a lot of debate, and I believe quite rightly, on whether or not the state legislatures that convened the Continental Congress had the authority to create the Constitution to begin with. Because their charge was to perfect the Articles of Confederation, and they did not do that. They threw out the entire lot and created something wholly new and different.
Well, if you look at our Constitution, we still have the right to do convene a new constitution.
We certainly do. And you know what? We have a right not to even bother with that and just give the federal government the big middle finger and walk away from them entirely. And, you know, even prior to the Civil War and the secession of the southern states, most people don't know this, but there was a northern secessionist movement in many of the New England states, where they were talking about seceding from the Union because the sitting president, Madison, had implemented a trade tariff that was killing their business. Because, of course, they were on the New England coast and they relied heavily on shipping trade. And it was killing their business with England. And was the reason for the War of 1812. So there was a secessionist movement led by a gentleman named John Jay in the New England states. The idea that the states could not withdraw from their union was ridiculous. Had they stuck with the Articles of Confederation, it was actually in the Articles of Confederation that they could not do that. It's not in the Constitution.
Understood, but doesn't federal law take precedence over state law?
No. You're talking about...
I mean, within the confines of the Constitution, of course.
Well, you're talking about the Supremacy Clause, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And here's the problem with the Supremacy Clause. And this was argued quite hotly at the Constitutional Convention. Let's take Arizona as an example, the state of Arizona, and they're passing their immigration law. I defy anyone to show me anything in the Constitution that authorizes the federal government to supersede Arizona's state law when Arizona's state law deals wholly and completely with the territory within the boundaries of that state and nothing else. It does not reach out and touch another state.
Oh, I agree with that. Yeah.
Okay. So the federal law does not supersede the state law. They cannot force, although they do, and I have to question Jan Brewer's intelligence or her honesty, because she granted jurisdiction to the federal district court by showing up to answer the charge in the case. She is president of Arizona. The federal government has no jurisdiction, and if you'll pick up that Constitution, you'll find the only jurisdiction the federal government has is inside the 10-mile square area known as the seat of government, Washington, D.C., and in any insular territories and possessions, or in areas that were ceded to the government by the state legislature. And
I have the Constitution in front of me. Can you point me to that particular part?
The jurisdiction. Well, let me get it out here.
Sorry to put you on the spot, but I want to be well informed.
Let's see. Oh, here it is. That is in Article 1, Section 8.
I just happen to be right there.
The Congress has the authority to raise and support armies, provide and maintain a navy, to make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces, calling forth the militia, provide for organizing, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here we go. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States. And to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, and to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States. That's their jurisdiction. 10 miles square, and, oh, I don't know, Fort Benning, Georgia. Now, at Fort Benning, Georgia, you would have to go back and look at the charter that was granted by the state of Georgia to the federal government to cede over that territory and see if, in the language of that grant, Georgia retained jurisdiction. In other words, it would be concurrent jurisdiction, meaning the state had jurisdiction as well as the federal government, so that if the state wanted to go in with the state patrol and arrest a military officer for murder, they were fully within their power and authority to do so. If it was exclusive jurisdiction, then the state could not set one foot on that piece of property without the federal government's authorization. So you see, the federal government is not and was never intended to be an all-powerful national government. It was meant to temper the state legislatures from becoming dictatorial. It set up and guaranteed to every state in the United States a Republican form of government.
I have to admit, I have been playing devil's advocate to a bit.
Okay. Well, I don't mind. That's fine.
Because I think it's important that we discuss these things and we get it out, all out in the open, and get it out. The stuff on Abe Lincoln, I'm not very well versed on that, so I'll have to do some research and figure that out. But in the meantime, I'm trying to gain some insight on other opinions so that I can get that out in my monthly journal. And
okay.
I'm also writing a book.
Fantastic. And,
we've got a lot of different aspects to do. And one thing you might want to consider is when you do your introduction, announce who you are. You know, what your name is and everything.
Okay.
So, anyway.
So what's your,
good information.
I mean, do
my
you
name's
have
Richard
a different.
Gates.
Do you have a different take on this, Richard? Or?
A lot of it I agree with. A lot of stuff you said about Abraham Lincoln. It's the first time I've been exposed to that, so I'll have to go back and look at it. But my experience right now is that, you know, we've got to get back to constitutional values, and the only way we're going to do that is by discussing it and writing about it, getting it out there.
Well, sure. And I think, you know, first and foremost, before we even get into the conversation of constitutional government, we don't know what that is and what it looks like. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, I am not a constitutional expert by any means, but I have read through it. I've read volumes of things. I have a lot of different interests, but my main interest is that, you know, the Constitution itself, I think we ought to be abiding by. And, you know, the taxing authority that was given to our Congress was not, as the courts have stated, plenary. It wasn't all-encompassing. Because regardless of the form of the tax, impost, duty, or fee, it has to be within the confines of the purpose for which Congress was given the authority to tax in the first place.
Oh, exactly.
And taking money out of my paycheck.
I think it was Madison that said that the authority to tax
that was Jefferson. The power to tax is the power to destroy.
Yeah. Are you sure that was Jefferson?
Pretty sure. I could be wrong. It has happened before. I am not perfect.
But, you know, I think a lot of our founders thought along the same lines, so they may have both had quotes on that.
Well, Madison had a little bit different idea. And actually, I think the power to tax was John Marshall. So we are both incorrect. Chief Justice John Marshall.
Oh, yeah. That would be right, because I just read from him yesterday. So yeah, that would fit right in.
Madison was quite the schemer. And if you follow the minutes of the convention, Madison actually used Hamilton as his mouthpiece. Very, very wisely, I think, because Madison had in mind a virtual monarchy for the states. Hamilton, of course, was a firm believer in British mercantilism, which basically what we would today call fascism.
Yep.
And Abraham Lincoln, who was a devout study of a gentleman who is actually one of my relatives, Henry Clay, who was the head of the Whig Party and who Andrew Jackson didn't like very much. But Clay was what we would today call a progressive. And the Hamiltonian ideology that Henry Clay and Abraham Lincoln followed was that you needed a strong national government that could tax the ever-living daylights out of the states, and what would come from that is all of the revenue would flow into the central government, and then the central government could dole out that money for internal improvement projects within the various states to repay their supporters. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. This
wow.
is how,
why does that sound familiar?
Right. This is why there were, oh my God. I mean, I'd have to go to the book and pull out the specific examples. There were so many boondoggles, and that's really where the name comes from. The state legislators already knew that this was a horrible idea, because when they tried doing this at the state level, it was so corrupt that it was just totally out of control. We had the first black congressional Congress, by the way, was formed in the state of Florida in 1872. And they were so pissed that their white counterparts were being paid $300 for their vote, and the blacks were only being paid $150 for their vote, that they formed a black congressional Congress within the state so that they could get equal suffrage and be paid $300 for their votes. And that is what we have to this very day. And that system, you know, if you look at our history from 1781, the Constitutional Convention ratification, 1789, going forward all the way up until 1860, there is this power struggle between the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians, those that saw it Jefferson's way and those that saw it Hamilton's way. And the Hamiltonians later became the Whig Party, which then became the Democratic Republicans. And so they were constantly pushing and prodding and trying to get in and implement their plan. But see, it wouldn't work unless you had a national government, which is what Hamilton proposed from the start, was a national government and eviscerating the states. Well, that didn't happen until Abraham Lincoln got into office. And once he was elected, he immediately undertook war against the southern states and states' rights. Now, we've always been told it's about slavery. Slavery was kind of like abortion is today. It's a hot button issue and it divides people, and there's a lot of fuss going back one side or the other. But slavery had very little to do other than a political talking point with the actual war. The reason the southern states seceded was not because they felt that slavery was under threat. It was because of the tariffs and taxes that they were having to bear from the northern states. They were financing northern mercantilism, and they knew it, and it was pissing them off.
And see, I've heard both sides of that argument. And I don't have an answer for that, because both sides of the argument are very convincing.
Well, you know, slavery was dying a slow and painful death simply because of the coming Industrial Revolution, if for no other reason. And every other country in the world walked away from slavery without fighting a war over it. It was, I think one of the reasons why Barack Obama admires and loves Abraham Lincoln so well is because, in the words of Rahm Emanuel, you never let a crisis go to waste.
So true.
And it was the crisis, and Lincoln being the study that he was of the Whig Party and the Hamiltonian British mercantilism system that they wanted to implement, knew that there was no way. He didn't have the votes in Congress. There was no way in H.E. double hockey sticks that he could have got anything approved as long as the southern states were there. And you know what? I think they did Lincoln a favor by walking out.
That could be. I'm definitely going to look into that a lot more, because I hadn't to this point, because I've been focused so much on our founding and the basic principles for our liberty. And but I'll look into Lincoln more, because you've raised some interesting points.
Well, I can give you the title of a book that is a very good read, and the title is The Real Lincoln by Thomas DiLorenzo. And, you know, Mr. DiLorenzo takes the time to brush aside all the glowing revisionist history and look at factually what happened.
Okay, well, that sounds real good. Anyway, 17th Amendment is one thing I would love to get repealed. I think that the progressive movement has completely crippled us as a nation.
I would agree. And I would also say that our progressive movement started with Abraham Lincoln. And I know a lot of people don't understand that, but I'm telling you, if you have not, if you're listening to the sound of my voice, if you have not read the Reconstruction Acts from 1867 to 1874, it is absolutely essential reading to understand the current nation that you live in, because we're clearly no longer a collection of free and independent states. And I can point you to an amendment in that Constitution, the 14th Amendment. And it's very critical, because the 14th Amendment says all persons born naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Now, if we go back to that Article 1, Section 8, and we remember what the jurisdiction of Congress is, right? The United States, their jurisdiction is that 10-mile square. And here we have this amendment saying that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, doesn't mean concurrent jurisdiction. It does not mean incidental jurisdiction. It means exclusive jurisdiction of Congress, which makes you a federal subject.
Okay, so how does Fabian socialism play into the progressive movement?
You know, I have no idea, to be quite honest with you. Fabian socialism is not something that I've read up on. I'm sure that Miss Linda could give us some insight into that, having read the books on that. I have been more focused on, you know, our constitutional government, and, you know, I've read quite a bit on Marx and Engels. Yeah, I found it interesting that Karl Marx actually wrote Abraham Lincoln a letter congratulating him on his re-election.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I've come across 63 goals of the Socialist Communist Party that were entered into the listing in Congress from 1963.
Yes.
And it's 45 different goals. And to read those, you would be astounded at the goals that they had about affecting our schools and education, just a whole lot of different issues. And you can just read them and say, well, yeah, they've been doing that. They've been doing that, too, and they're working on that. And Well, we kind of headed them off at the pass on this one, but they've still got the other ones going on. And so I think that there's a lot of aspects that we've got to look at that are from outside the United States as well that are influencing our politics today.
I would certainly not disagree with that.
Yeah, and so we've got a lot of fronts to cover. We have got so many things that we've got to take care of and we have to be on guard for.
Well, you know, I actually, in that same line of thinking, I read an article today where Mitt Romney was saying that he would actually support the idea of a value-added tax.
Oh, he didn't say that, did he?
Oh, he most and certainly did. Now, granted, what he said was that he would see the value-added tax as a possible way of removing the corporate income tax and replacing it with a value-added tax. I say tomato, tomato. If you're looking at a value-added tax, you got your head in the wrong hemisphere.
Oh, I agree. I agree 100%. I'm a very vigilant fair tax supporter.
Now, see, I understand the idea behind the fair tax, and I understand a lot of people supporting it. My whole problem with the fair tax is it's just, you know, it's still robbing Peter to pay Paul. I think we're splitting hairs as to whether you want to take money out of your left pocket or your right pocket. The idea that repealing the 16th Amendment would remove the ability of the income tax is facetious.
Why do you say so?
Well, it's not me that says so. It's the Supreme Court that said so. In the tax case, Brushaber versus Union Pacific Railroad, they said quite literally, quite plainly and clearly, that the 16th Amendment did not confer any new taxing power to the Congress. It did not allow Congress to tax any accepted subjects. It did not increase or alter the taxing authority of Congress one iota.
Really? And it's,
absolutely.
I guess it has no... no basis in the corruption of Congress. It has no effect on lobbyists.
The 16th Amendment, I don't think it does, no.
The 16th Amendment is an abomination. It has to go.
According to the Supreme Court, the 16th Amendment is little more than a clarification.
We have 72,000 pages of tax code right now.
I'm fully aware of the tax code.
It's been a political football for lobbyists and congressional elected officials for 100 years.
Well, let me ask you something. Are you familiar with the term positive law?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, there's 50 titles to the United States Code, and not all 50 titles have been enacted into positive law. One of the titles that has not been enacted into positive law is Title 26, which is the Internal Revenue Code, the tax code.
Okay.
And again, we would have to go back to that jurisdiction thing, wouldn't we?
Well, let me ask you this. If you are behind on your taxes, can the IRS just come in and seize your property?
The IRS can do any damned thing they want. However,
exactly.
Well, now hang on a minute. However, they must have the aid and assistance of the state and local authorities to do so.
But they can do it.
Only if the state allows them.
Well, they will do it, and
oh, you're not telling me anything. Trust
yeah.
me. I'm paying an attorney in California right now to fight the IRS on my behalf. So
okay.
you're not telling
so
me anything I don't know.
Well, let's get rid of it.
I agree. But you think that the fair tax will get rid of the Internal Revenue Service, and I'm telling you that you're going to end up with two taxes.
No, you won't.
Why not?
Because H.R. 25 has a sunset clause. You either get rid of the IRS and the 16th Amendment, or it goes away.
Okay.
I've got the bill. I've printed
no,
it
that,
out.
That,
135 pages.
That's fine. But, okay, so you get rid of the 16th Amendment. That still doesn't get rid of the Congress's ability to tax your income.
No, it does.
No, it doesn't. I'm sorry. It does not.
Why not?
Why not? Because the 16th Amendment does not grant Congress the authority to tax income. They already had that.
Yes, it does.
No, it does not. I'm sorry, but it just doesn't.
Sir, I will read it to you if you want me to. I mean, it does.
I can read it to you verbatim from memory. And I can also read to you the Supreme Court case, the very first case that arose under the 16th Amendment, which was Brushaber versus Union Pacific Railroad. And it was heard in 1916. Okay? Now, Brushaber was a foreign individual from France who was living in New York City and had retirement income stocks from the Union Pacific Railroad. And the government was taxing the proceeds of his stock as income, and he argued they can't do that, and the Supreme Court said, yes, they can. And they said, well, the 16th Amendment is unconstitutional, and they said, no, it's not. And here's why it's not. That the appellant argues in error that the 16th Amendment created some hitherto unknown taxing authority for Congress. It didn't do that. They said the 16th Amendment simply identifies the object of the tax, income. Now,
the idea of an amendment is to change the Constitution.
I understand what the idea of an amendment is.
It rewrites the Constitution.
Not always. Not always. And the 16th Amendment is a perfect example. And I'll tell you why. Go read the decision in the Pollock case, 1894. That was the case that created the controversy that brought about the 16th Amendment. See, in the Pollock case, Mr. Pollock owned some rental property. And the money that he got from rent, the government was taxing. And he said, hold on, wait a minute. This is unconstitutional because you are, in effect, putting a property tax on my property. That's a direct tax, and it has to be apportioned according to the Constitution. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, Mr. Pollock, you are exactly correct. Now, the federal government didn't want to go back and rewrite the entire tax code that they had just exhaustively worked to bring about. So what they did was create the 16th Amendment. And the 16th Amendment was telling the court and Mr. Pollock that, no, we are not indeed taxing your property. What we are taxing is any profit that you made from the sale or rental of your property. And it is only that profit, otherwise known as income, that is the object of the tax. It's just that simple. And I defy you to find in the tax code the definition of the word income, because it is not in there.
In 72,000 pages. Wow.
72,000 pages. I'll give you the chapter and verse where you can find the definition of gross income, and it is Title 26, Section 61. And it is very misleading, and it's done that way intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Section 61 gives a definition of gross income. Okay?
Okay.
So So in order for you to have gross income, you would first have to have income, right?
Right.
You'll notice that in gross income, they're not defining what income is or what it isn't. They're just saying if you have gross income, no matter what source it came from, which is what got Al Capone popped, okay, even if it came from engaging in a prostitution ring, and it's illegal, prostitution's illegal in your state, doesn't matter. If you earned profit from that venture, it's taxable as income. And always was, with or without the 16th Amendment.
Okay, so now, income tax the right way to go?
I think that we should take a page out of the Founders' Playbook.
And Jefferson said that we should not be taxing and taking bread out of the mouth of labor.
That is correct, but that's exactly what we're doing. And now the government goes through these, to quote a Supreme Court justice, linguistic gymnastics to rationalize the idea that taxing your paycheck is not a direct tax within the meaning of that term in the Constitution. And I find it interesting that the various courts in the United States cannot agree. Hell, they don't even agree. And I find it laughable that the various federal district courts within the United States of America do not agree on the meaning of the 16th Amendment, even though we have a 16th Amendment case in Brushaber versus Union Pacific, which unequivocally lays it out in as plain a language as possible.
Well, I can tell you it is definitely a direct tax when it comes right out of your paycheck every week.
Well, let me explain to you the government's tabled argument, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you get up and go to work and you get paid, you're getting free money. Everything you earn is pure profit because you paid nothing for your ability to labor. Nothing. Didn't cost you anything.
Really?
Absolutely.
I would disagree with that.
Oh, well, a lot of people have, and some of them are still in prison for it. But nonetheless, the government doesn't
see
it.
Well, and here's why. You have to have work clothes. You have to have transportation. You have to find a way to get to work. There are expenses going to work.
Certainly, and you know what? Congress has provided you write-offs and deductions for all of those things.
Oh, no, they haven't.
Sure they have.
No,
I get to write off the cost of my uniforms. I get to write off the cost of my travel if I want to actually sit down and you know, if I've got to go to a different store, say they need me to cover for somebody at a different store, I get to write down my travel from my store to that store and back home again.
Okay, so I'm a government servant, and I am actually a tax preparer, and I'm doing the work of the government so that I can save some money on my taxes.
Right. Well, you know, there was a lady, and I believe it was 1945 that argued that the government could not force her by any kind of legislation to be an unpaid tax collector, and she won. There's very few people that have stood up to the Internal Revenue Service and won, and you never hear about those stories on the news. There was a gentleman in Nevada who owned a construction company, and he paid his employees in cash, but it was the form of cash that he chose to pay his employees in that got him in hot water, almost. You see, he paid his employees in silver dollars. So yep. a person at, you know, at $30 an ounce for silver coins, a person making $600 a week would be paid, literally, by law, $20. $20. In legal tender U.S. silver dollars. Do you know what the reporting requirements are for a business that pays someone $20 a week?
No.
Zero.
No.
Zero. There is zero withholding of any kind. Well, the government didn't like that much, as you can well imagine. So they sent a team of IRS, Criminal Investigation Division thugs out there with their guns and their flak jackets, and, you know, they raided the place. And after 18 months, a jury acquitted him of all charges.
Well, there you go. I mean, the 16th Amendment has to go. There's just no doubt in my mind it has to go.
Yeah, well, we can disagree on that. In my mind, the 16th Amendment is irrelevant.
It's one of two amendments passed under Woodrow Wilson.
Well, certainly.
And his progressive agenda.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe, because I pay my taxes, I get my deductions taken out, and I just see this going from bad to worse on the taxes, especially at the end of this year. If things don't get changed in Congress.
Well, I've got Miss Linda on the phone. But
hey, how are you doing? Hi,
hey, Miss Linda, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Just kind of, I was enjoying listening because I'm getting an education too, and you know, we've gone over a lot of these things before, but it's always good to hear it, so it, you know, gets into the memory banks. I hate all the stuff they've been doing since Lincoln's time. It's disgusting, and I, you know, you're right. We just have to stop complying, and if we don't like the governor that, you know, given credence to the IRS to come take your property, get out of that state.
Well, let me read you a little bit. I'm going to interrupt you for just a second, and then you can continue, and then I want to find the real meat of the opinion, but. This is Brushaber versus Union Pacific Railroad, Mr. Chief Justice White delivering the opinion of the court. As a stockholder of the Union Pacific Railroad Company, the appellant, that would be Mr. Brushaber, filed his bill to enjoin the corporation from complying with the income tax provisions of the Tariff Act of October 3, 1913. Because of constitutional questions duly arising, the case is here on direct appeal from a decree sustaining a motion to dismiss because ground for relief was stated. Now, they go on to say, aside from the arguments as to citizenship and residence of Mr. Brushaber, as I stated before, he was from France and not an American citizen at the time. The various propositions are so intermingled as to cause it to be difficult to classify them. We are of the opinion, however, that the confusion is not inherent, but rather arises from the conclusion that the 16th Amendment provides for a hitherto unknown power of taxation, that is, a power to levy an income tax which, although direct, should not be subject to the regulation of apportionment applicable to all other direct taxes. And they go on to say that is flatly wrong. It doesn't do any of that. It says, but let us, by demonstration of the error of the fundamental proposition as to the significance of the amendment, dispel the confusion necessarily arising from the arguments deduced from it. Before coming, however, to the text of the amendment, to the end that is significance may be determined in the light of the previous legislative and judicial history of the subject with which the amendment is concerned, and with a knowledge of conditions which presumptively led to its adoption, and therefore of the purpose it was intended to accomplish, we make a brief statement. The authority conferred upon the Congress by Section 8 of Article 1 to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, excises is exhaustive and embraces every conceivable power of taxation, has never been questioned, or, if it has been so often authoritatively declared as to render it necessary only to state the doctrine. In other words, Congress can tax the crap out of whatever they want, any way they want, as long as they stay within the boundaries of the Constitution, meaning that it has to be for the specific purposes laid out and in the manner laid out. In other words, duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform, and direct taxes shall be apportioned, and no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census.
And the 16th Amendment abolished all of that.
No, that's what the court is telling him. Let us demonstrate the error of the fundamental position of the appellant, Mr. Brushaber. He made that same argument. The court says, we're going to demonstrate to you your fundamental error in taking that position because you're dead wrong. It didn't do any of that.
The cheeseburger, no onion, and the french fries.
So how is it that half of America doesn't pay any tax at all?
You got to ask your Congress about that one. They're the ones that set the limits.
In 72,000 pages, there are so many gimmies and setbacks. And now, right now, you have Warren Buffett and all these ultra-rich people that are coming out and saying, oh, yeah, raise our taxes. Well, the only reason I can see they would want their taxes raised is because it stymies all new competition. Because the taxes are so high, the new competition won't come up.
Well, I think that they're being facetious because they know that you can try to raise their taxes and they're simply going to pigeonhole their money elsewhere. And, you know, it doesn't really matter. It simply doesn't matter. Mitt Romney and the rest of them pay an effective tax rate of somewhere between 10 and 16%. I pay an effective tax rate of 29%. Just in federal tax, and that's not including, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, okay? And I'm one of those
Just for a second there, I want to thank you for paying my taxes.
Yeah, well, you're welcome, I guess.
That's what I'm saying. It's not a fair tax system.
Well,
I make about $30,000 a year, okay? So how come I don't pay any taxes?
Well, because Congress has determined that since you don't make enough money, they're not going to punish you like they punish me.
Well,
then
I should have to contribute something, shouldn't I?
Well, I agree. And you see, this goes back to the very beginning of the program where we were talking about the role of president. And, you know, the fact that we heard the woman in California saying, you know, when Obama got elected, she says, now I don't have to worry about putting gas in my car or paying my rent. See, it's all about what the government can give you. And that's really not what it was about.
Well, right now, 22% of everything that we buy is embedded taxes. Okay, so I really am paying taxes. I'm just not making a big contribution to the income tax. but I'm paying those embedded taxes that other people are paying along the way in the manufacturer. So why not have a fair tax where we get the underground economy paying a tax so that when they go and purchase something, they pay a sales tax that actually shows up on a sales receipt.
Certainly.
And you don't have to worry about it.
That's really almost another way of saying a value-added tax. But before
and
we...
No, it's a whole different... That's a whole different
ballgame. I understand. Look, I'm in Georgia, and I heard Neil Bortz touting the fair tax with John Linder for years. But let me explain to you why I believe the fair tax is a red herring at best, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree that our current government is far too large and far too intrusive?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you advocate a new taxing scheme that would allow them to continue on their current path.
No.
First and foremost, absolutely. It would generate more revenue inflows into the current government. Now, what do you think that they're going to do with that additional money?
Well, we're $16 trillion in debt.
Well, they damn sure aren't going to use it to pay that, now are they?
Well, you know what? That depends on what we do.
I don't think it does. They have. How do you think we got to $16 trillion in debt? It certainly was not by the federal government paying their bills.
And so
giving them more money.
So your solution is to just keep the current system and try to cut spending.
No, my solution is to get rid of the system that instituted this damned income tax to begin with. We lived all the way until 1913 without an income tax, okay, with the exception of a brief period during the tenure of one Abraham Lincoln, or actually after his 1871 is when they repealed the first income tax that was enacted in the United States, and that was to fund his war. And even that he recognized wasn't enough, which is why they issued greenbacks, which instantly devalued everyone else's currency overnight. But that's a whole nother argument. The problem is that the taxing authority of Congress acted as a restraint on Congress up until 1913.
I agree with that.
And we did not have a fair tax in 1905. We did not have an income tax in 1905. So what did we have?
Well, the whole thing is right now we're looking at $16 trillion worth of debt, and we've got to pay that off.
It can't be done.
Yes, it can.
It absolutely cannot.
Why not?
Well, it's really a mathematical economic issue. How much currency is in circulation in the United States of America right now, today?
That one I don't know.
Okay. So let's make up a number. Just for the sake of argument, we'll say that the amount of currency, and when I say currency, I don't mean just paper and coins. I mean checking deposits and loan money, electronic money, all of those things. Let's say that it's $25 trillion. Total monetary supply in the United States is $25 trillion. Okay?
Okay.
Now, what is the Federal Reserve and Congress doing with the bailout, with TARP, with QE1, QE2? What was the purpose of all of those, what they tell us, the purpose of all of those undertakings? What was that for?
And that was supposed to bail out our economy, but it didn't work.
And how was it going to accomplish bailing out the economy?
Green jobs and whatever.
Well, right, but the point is that the reason that they said this was a bailing out the economy was that it was supposed to inject capital money into the marketplace.
Yep.
Okay? So it was supposed to expand the amount of money in circulation. But you're talking about paying off the national debt, which would do the opposite of expanding the amount of currency in circulation. It would contract the economy, which is exactly and precisely what occurred in 1929 with the crash of the stock market. And it would send us spiraling into a Great Depression. But even if we just for a moment look at our national debt at $16 trillion, that is chump change. We have over $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities that are not on the budget moving forward. That's why you're going to hear Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan talking about saving Medicare, saving Social Security, because those entitlement programs are where that $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities is at. And one of their answers to saving that is to divide it up and block grant it out to the states. That, my friends, will be a travesty beyond imagination. However, to put it into context, $200 trillion is more than the gross domestic product of every nation on the globe. It cannot be paid. That's the problem that Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, the whole of the EU, that's the problem they're faced with right now. They can't pay their debts. Hell, Japan has been running for decades at more than 200% debt to GDP. They put every penny back into infrastructure because they know that if they lose their ability to have a cheap currency worldwide compared to everyone else, and their ability to produce and sell exports, they are screwed like a turtle on his back.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple of questions real quick.
Sure.
Four hundred corporations have said that they, if the fair tax was enacted, they would move their business or their corporate headquarters back to the United States. So we stand to gain a huge amount. We would have the lowest corporate taxes, which would be zero, around the world.
Well, we have zero. Our corporate tax stands today at zero. So I don't get that.
No, it doesn't.
Sure, it does.
We have the highest corporate tax in the world right now, sir.
Well, I'm going to tell you, corporations don't pay taxes.
But the corporate tax rate
doesn't matter.
Highest in the world.
Doesn't matter. Where do the corporations get the money to pay those taxes?
But the ability of America. No, look, hear me out.
Okay.
The ability of American companies to compete based in the United States is their ability to pay their taxes and not pass on those kind of taxes. I know they're going to pass those taxes on to the consumer.
Can I get a cup
right.
of water?
That's what an excise tax is. An excise tax is a tax that you can pass on. It's one that doesn't directly tax the individual or the corporation. Consumers are paying that. But as long as you have a Federal Reserve system with a central economic planning mechanism, I don't care how much money and how much growth you bring back into the United States of America, it will not solve our problem with an out-of-control government. It will add to the problem. The government will become even more enormous. And I'm going to tell you something else.
Sure.
Just the very idea that it would entice corporations to move their businesses back to the United States of America is first and foremost the fundamental reason why Congress will never pass that. Under Ronald Reagan in 1981, the Senate ratified UNIDO, which is the United Nations Industrialization Development Organization. That is an organization within the United Nations that uses your tax dollars to send U.S. jobs to foreign countries to industrialize the third world countries. It's all part
of the answer. Did nothing?
It's all part of a plan for interdependence. You see, the United States has been too self-sufficient. We must become dependent on all the third world countries that have Coca-Cola and General Motors and all these other productive businesses that used to be here in their countries. See, and in that way, we are interdependent on all the global economy and we're not self-sufficient. The answer is, quite clearly, get rid of the Federal Reserve System, get rid of central economic planning, go back to a competing currency. And, you know, I don't care if it's a gold standard, a silver standard, a paper standard, a seashell standard. Okay? The first problem and the one mistake that I see in our Constitution is that Congress was given the authority to fix the value of currency. And that is the fundamental problem. Because as soon as the government says that whatever you're using as currency is worth two cheeseburgers, we're off to the races. And it creates an economic imbalance.
So, Ron, is that what you just described, kind of like in the central planning world, price fixing?
It's exactly what it is.
Okay.
I'm reading about it. Yep, it is absolutely 100% price fixing. And
wow.
The very idea that one man or 100 men mm-hmm. can sit in a boardroom
right.
and calculate the correct market price for any commodity, whether it be gold, silver, oil, cotton, corn,
sure.
or paper dollars, is a fallacy to end all fallacies. They cannot do it. And that is why we have had continual problems. There are always going to be ups and downs in any market period. This is, mm-hmm. ladies and gentlemen, this is the fundamental principle that leads to socialism and communism.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Because they simply can't get their brain around the fact that as long as you screw around with the market mechanism, you create a disproportionate economic system which drives a huge wedge into society between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
They create all these different ideologies and ways to get around the one simple fact that they will never admit. They can't do it.
Yeah, see, this is the ideology that 100 people or, say, 535 idiotic people, that they can somehow predict and then manage everything, whether it's free enterprise, commodities, money, who's going to buy what invention's better than the next. I mean, it's sick, and that's the problem. Let the free market and real, true, unbridled capitalism get these clowns out of there. Let it flow, and it'll be fine.
Absolutely.
The market takes care of itself. Yes, it does.
One of the fallacies, and you know, the article I sent you some time ago and the article that I posted in my blog on Patriot Families, and I picked it apart, mm-hmm. they ignore the one common problem. And the writer of that article trying to poo-poo a gold standard, which I don't much care to me one way or the other. Actually, the constitutional standard is silver. Gold is secondary, but that's a whole other discussion. Mm-hmm. What that gentleman was attempting to do was create a straw man argument against a gold mm-hmm. standard, and he cherry-picked a point in time in our history, 1800 to 1870s,
right.
I believe it was, okay, where he talks about all these huge swings. Well, if you go and read about that time frame in our economic history, you'll see some very interesting things occurred. One of the things that occurred, by the way, is the only time in the history of the United States of America that we had zero national debt, none.
Wow.
And that time was immediately following the Andrew Jackson administration, because Jackson killed the central bank and refused to reaffirm their charter. And it didn't happen while he was still in office. It took a while for things to pick up. And what he did was he moved all the government's accounts out of the central bank and put them in local banks, spread it out. And it wasn't very long, about 8 years after his presidency, that the United States of America had zero debt, none. Only time it has ever occurred in our entire history.
Man, it's a great argument to get rid of the Fed.
So if you want to pay off that $16 trillion national debt, the first thing you've got to do is get rid of the system that perpetuates that debt. That's the very first thing you have to do. Close the checkbook on Congress so that Congress cannot just write themselves a loan and spend money that they didn't collect through revenues.
It was just a book entry, right?
Correct.
Wow.
A book entry that's hanging a millstone of taxation upon future generations that cannot be paid. It is mathematically impossible. But not to worry, because it's mathematically impossible to pay the outstanding debt globally. And so they're going to be forced at some point in time to come up with a solution, a reset, if you want.
Mm.
What that will look like, God only knows, but I can guarantee you one thing, it won't include you and me.
Huh.
Well, I think it has to.
No, sir. The government, whatever thing they do, will not absolve you of your current outstanding debt. It will only absolve the governments of their current outstanding debts to one another.
I don't accept the premise that we have to be absolved of any debt. What we've got to do is find solutions.
Well, the solution is clear, and Congress is unwilling, and so is your president.
He ain't my president. I didn't vote for him.
The only way you're going to pay off the debt is to call the Rothschilds.
all you have to do, quite literally, is look at every member of Congress and the president and see where most of their campaign contributions come from. And if you don't see banks at the top of that list, you're not looking.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
I
was running for Congress.
Well, so you got to ask yourself, why is it that all these congressmen, all their major donations come from banks? See, it was Jefferson that penned the quote that banks pose a greater danger to our nation than standing armies. And he was right.
Oh, I agree
with
that.
So until we have a serious conversation in this country about reforming our monetary policy, it's all for naught, brother. If you leave, Rothschild is the one that said, give me the power to issue a nation's currency, and I care not who writes its laws. And you strip away a banker, you take everything he owns and leave him a ballpoint pen, and with the click of that pen, he can create money.
Horrible.
You know, I saw a great quote the other day. It says, give a man a gun, he can rob a bank. Give a man a bank, he can rob the world.
Oh, I saw that too. That was good. They are.
That's the truth. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Until we can get to a honest monetary system where they cannot just hypothecate and rehypothecate debt as money,
horrible, I know.
We will not see a solution. And we will receive debt slaves.
We will see a solution when people stand and take notice of what's going on and they get their voice out there. That's when we'll see a solution.
Well, until the people wake up, and I'm going to tell you, we had a perfect opportunity in 2008 and an even better opportunity this time around to elect a man president who would do exactly what he says, who would not go back on a single campaign promise, and who understands the fundamental problem that our country faces. And the people reject him. They would rather have their ears tickled and vote for a liar and a flip-flopping jackass than
Who would that person be, sir?
There's only one, Ron Paul.
Really?
Absolutely.
400 bills that he submitted to Congress, only two were passed into law.
And what the hell does
Please
that have to do?
Please explain to me how that is leadership.
First of all, we don't elect leaders, sir. There are servants, not leaders. If you're looking for a leader, go vote for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama. I think they've got a whole throng of people following after them like rats to the Pied Piper.
Okay,
if you want a solution,
let me ask you another question.
The United States of America, you elect a president named Ron Paul.
So let me ask you another question then.
Certainly.
How is it that Ron Paul can put all his pork barrel spending into bills that he knows are going to get passed and then votes against them? How is that leadership?
Well, again, that's the example we need for America. Okay, what is the purpose of the House of Representatives? What is their job? What is their role? Where do they come from?
Their purpose is to represent the people of the United States.
It is? I thought they were representing the people of their congressional district, their constituents.
Well, that's why there's so many of them.
Exactly. Now, let me ask you something. All that money that Dr. Paul is sending in these pork barrel projects back to his constituents, where does all that money come from?
It comes from the American taxpayer.
It comes from his damned constituents. They're the taxpayers sending that money to the government. His job is to get that money back to them or as much of it as he possibly can. That is his whole purpose for existing, sir. You have fallen into the trap of the John McCain, I'll make you famous, horse manure that is the biggest red herring to come down the pike since Congress was initiated. The whole purpose of the House of Representatives is to represent their people who are paying taxes into the daggum federal government.
And so he votes no against all these bills, right?
I'm sorry?
And so he votes no against all these bills that he stuffs this pork into.
You can call it pork.
Yeah, that's pretty upfront.
It is very upfront. He is doing his job, sir. And it's a shame that we don't have about 300 more just like him. Because
really?
He puts that
stuff into these bills and he won't even vote for them?
Oh, but all of his fellow congressmen just run right up and vote for him and send that money out the door like it was on fire. But it's his fault that they do that, right?
I find that deceptive. I find that deceptive.
Deceptive?
Yes, sir.
Ron Paul is to blame because all the other members of Congress don't have the same level of integrity that he has.
On just this one precept, I find him to be deceptive and without principle.
Well, Richard, if you were running for Congress, okay?
I did.
Great. So you get elected to Congress. You're representing the people of your congressional district. You put forth a bill, and one of the other members adds something to that bill, and you know in your heart of hearts that that bill is not constitutional. Do you vote
in favor
of it?
No.
Exactly. Thank you. And that's exactly what Dr. Paul says. Now, if everybody else in the House of Representatives votes in favor of that bill, is it your fault?
That is such a weak excuse.
Weak
that really
excuse.
Is.
It's not an excuse, sir. It's a question.
I would not put in a pork bill or a pork amendment or whatever.
So you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't do anything to bring the tax dollars that your constituents have paid into the government back to them where it rightfully belongs. So
I
you
would do that. I would do that on principles. I would do that on bills that I would support, that I could faithfully vote yes for. I would not do that in such a deceptive manner. I'm sorry, sir. That's something we're going to have to disagree on.
It floors me that people bring up this argument that Ron Paul, he has the audacity to actually represent his constituents. I find that amazing. And yeah, they call him Dr. No for a reason, because he looks at a bill, and if it's not constitutional, he votes against it, regardless of how much he would like to do whatever it says in the bill. And as he said
again,
himself,
I think it's a point we're going to have to disagree on. I know a lot of other people, they're friends of mine, and some of them support Ron Paul, and I just can't go along with him.
But the problem is, Richard, maybe you don't understand that Dr. Paul understands monetary policy probably better than anybody that's running it right now. He gets it. He hates the Fed, and rightfully so, because it's a Ponzi scheme, and it's evil. And it has been since its inception. So I don't see why you have a problem with him when he's following the Constitution in every aspect of it.
I understand it. I have major disagreements with his statements in the past on foreign policy.
Oh, here we go. Okay, you can take it, Ron. I know we're in archives.
Well, you know, Richard, with all due respect, and I'm not trying to beat you up here, okay?
Oh, I understand.
But with all due respect, you're part of the problem.
And I've been told that before.
I wonder why. Have you ever stopped to think about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, we have to stop. You were talking about reading about our founding and you know, trying to understand how our government is supposed to work. Okay? And the point is that we didn't get to $16 trillion in debt. One, overnight. It didn't happen overnight. It's happened over a myriad of decades.
Since 1880, I believe.
Okay. So if we go all the way back to 1880 and we look at what's wrong with the system, it's everything that you guys keep saying you're supporting about the system. If you're not willing to look at monetary policy first and foremost, and entitlement programs secondly, then you're never going to solve the problem. It's like saying you're going to keep beating your head against the wall, and someday that wall is going to give way. I think it's safe to say at this point in time in our existence as a republic that everything that's been tried in the past has failed and continues to fail, with one exception. I gave you the reference, Andrew Jackson, 1835. the only time this country has had no national debt. If that is the goal, if the goal is to have no national debt, and if the goal is to return the power of money to the people, to the individual people, and not to the bankers and to Congress, then there's only one way clear to do that. Andrew Jackson was a bastard.
Thank you.
But he did get one thing right: ending the central bank.
Well, I can tell you this. I have served 10 years in the military.
Okay.
And I love this country. And I don't believe Ron Paul has the solution. I just don't. I don't think he has a solution for this country.
And that, sir, I'm going to tell you, in my humble opinion, is what's wrong with this country. Because we don't recognize the solution when it's given. Because we don't like it. We want to keep the status quo, even though we fuss and jump up and down and say that we want change. The only change we really want is for our guy to be in power.
Nope.
Well, if you want to go back to a constitutional form of government, sir, you would first and foremost need to get rid of the Federal Reserve Bank. Because the Constitution did not grant authority to create a central bank anywhere.
I agree with that.
Okay.
But I can tell you that we do have a constitutional form of government. We have a representative form of government. And that we have to elect based on results from primaries. And we have to accept that we're not going to get the perfect candidate. We're just not going to do it.
Well, there's no such thing as a perfect candidate.
And I think we're going to get, with Romney, I think we're going to get a good candidate.
He, you know, Mitt Romney might be a fabulous president. But I'm going to tell you right now what Mitt Romney will not be able to do.
Okay.
He will not be able to solve the problem.
Which problem? We have a lot of them.
Well, there's one problem. And from that one problem stems all the symptoms.
Yep.
There's a cancer. And that cancer is spreading, and it's touching every life in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Even those that don't recognize it, even those that don't understand it. And that's okay. I'm not going to try to belittle you as a guest because you don't understand economics and don't understand our central monetary system. That doesn't mean that I have to be rude and you know, impolite. I'm sorry that you don't understand it. And I wish more citizens would take the time and expend the energy to understand it. Because if they did, the election would be over in a minute.
Okay.
But until that time, until we reach a majority in this country that fully understands the nature and the root, the foundation of all that has come about, you're not going to get any change. You'll have a change in membership up at the White House. You may even have a change in Congress. But I would propose to you that we've had several changes in Congress and in the White House over the last 80 plus years, and it hasn't kept us from ending up at $16 trillion in debt and unfunded liabilities as far as the eye can see, and total graft corruption from one end of the system to the other. Now, you had mentioned wanting to get lobbyists out of the game and funding all these congressmen. Do you know that there's one door up there in the Congress, one office that the lobbyists, they won't even go up and knock on the door? One guy. They don't even call his office. His name's Ron Paul. Now, why do you suppose that those lobbyists will stop at every other congressional office on the Hill, but they won't even bother with Ron Paul? Why do you reckon that is? Probably because he's such a hypocrite and a pork barrel tender that these lobbyists, you'd think they'd be slobbering at his feet, but they're not. Why not?
I can just only tell you my own opinion on that is that I wouldn't bother to knock on his door because I don't support him.
Well, exactly, and you're not going to get his support by trying to buy it because he's not buying.
I'm not selling.
But the lobbyists sure as hell are. They're selling to everybody else, aren't they?
Not particularly.
Not particularly.
Richard, it's been great. Ron, it's been great. I'm walking into a meeting, Angel, so I got to run. And
be
thank
good,
you
hon.
So much for... Okay.
Yeah, have a good
care.
Night.
Thanks. Bye.
You know.
Have a good night.
He also doesn't take part in the congressional pension program.
Well, you know, that's all great.
It is, because he doesn't take government.
But the thing,
he returns
the thing,
a good.
The thing is, we can do some great things with tax reform and some other issues. We can get it done. It may not solve all of our problems, but it goes a long ways towards it. And it sets us off on a good footing.
Tax reform, the type that you're suggesting, whether it is the fair tax or any other taxing scheme, is simply, in my humble opinion, arguing over whether you want to take the money to pay the government out of your left pocket or out of your right pocket. The whole idea...
That's fine, but I think we take a lot of the political power out of the lobbyists.
How do you do that? How do you do that? How exactly do you do that through tax reform?
Well, because with the fair tax, it's the sales tax. It shows up on your sales receipt.
Right. So how does that take power away from the lobbyists in Washington, D.C.? Simply because you're paying your income tax under the title of fair tax whenever you go and buy a loaf of bread or a six-pack of beer, rather than paying it once, you know, every paycheck. Everything you're talking about is arguing semantics.
How many people even know how much tax they actually pay? Most people
know how much their refund is. I have no idea what a refund looks like, sir.
So, yeah. So, at my level, most people know how much refund they get. They don't know how much tax they're paying.
They're not paying any.
Really? So,
if you're getting a refund...
That's what... A lot of people that make $30,000-$40,000 a year, that's what they look at. That's all they see because it comes out every paycheck.
A lot of them get back every penny they paid in, like my daughter. She got back more than she paid in because she happened
sure,
to have
exactly.
People. Okay, so that's not a tax refund by any stretch of the imagination. That's a government subsidy.
Yeah.
They're using my money to subsidize it.
And what about all the people that get paid cash under the table or that are
Yeah, boy, those rotten bastards. We ought to just steal all their money too. You know, if the government's going to steal my money, they ought to steal theirs too.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
When you go buy something, you pay a tax.
I was being sarcastic. See, I don't believe the government. I don't believe the government should be entitled to the fruits of my labor or anyone else's labor.
No, but if you know what, we're going to have the taxes one way or the other.
Oh yeah, death and taxes—only two things that are certain.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I would say, you know, at least when you go buy something, you decide.
What if you're going to pay a tax? What if I told you that the federal government doesn't need to collect a penny in tax revenue? It's unnecessary.
And how would that work?
How would that work? How in the hell did you get $16 trillion in debt, sir? It wasn't by collecting tax revenue. It was by borrowing money from the central bank.
Okay. So we're going to get money from the central bank.
Yep.
And you're telling me we need to get rid of the central bank.
We do.
So how do you equate that?
How do I equate that? Well, I mean, go back and look at what the founders did. How did we run the country without this magic bank?
Well, I'm just saying, you're telling me that we don't have to collect taxes because we can get it from the central bank, and then you're telling me the central bank is bad.
Well, I'm telling you the reality under the current system.
But we want to fix the current system.
Oh, well, if you want to fix the current system, then you got to get rid of the whole reason for the income tax to begin with. See, you're under this false impression that the money that people pay in taxes is used to fund the government. But Ronald Reagan and the Grace Commission proved that that just was a flat-out lie. Now, granted, the Grace Commission was done a long time ago. Maybe things have changed, but I kind of doubt it. What the Grace Commission found is that out of every dollar collected under the individual income tax, not 1 cent, not a penny, goes to fund any government services or project. Not 1 cent.
Okay.
Where must it go then? What's the purpose of it? If it's not funding the government, why in the hell do we have it?
I'm listening.
Well, I would tell you that the reason that you have that income tax is because the government wants you to understand that they control you. They control you. If they can take 10% of your check, they can take 90%. If they can take 90%, they can take 100%.
Yep.
They can do whatever the hell they want to you. And even at 100%, not $1 going into the government pays to run the government. A third goes to absolute waste. A third goes to pay all those tax refunds you were talking about. And the last third, oh, well, it goes to service the interest on the money they're borrowing from the Fed, the central bank, and that's how they're funding all these friggin' programs. See, but as long as you think that we have to have all of these programs, like NAFTA and GATT and welfare and food stamps and the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Education and the EPA and all these other wonderful alphabet soup gang things, and as long as you believe that the government should take care of us from cradle to grave, then you must maintain the system as it is. If you actually want to reform government, and get back to a constitutional government, by the book constitutional government, well, then you're going to have to get rid of those things.
And obviously you haven't read anything that I've written. Because I am against all of those things.
You're against all of those things, and yet, you're absolutely against the one man out of 535 that has espoused every single one of those virtues for over 30 years. And he's not only said it, he's acted it out through his actions day after day after day. He's never changed his story. He's never flip-flopped, not even once. Sir, I challenge you to find another that fits that mold. Stop listening to John McCain and the talking heads within the Republican Party and the Democrat Party that are telling you about all these pork barrel spending and this is a problem. And look at the reality of our situation.
You know what? I can't even stand John McCain.
Neither can I. He's a jackass.
But I do have my own opinion, and it's based on Ron Paul's own statements.
And it's okay to have an
opinion. It's not based on any talking heads or any of that.
Okay.
It's based on what Ron Paul has said himself.
Like?
And that's the way I run. I
understand. All I'm telling you is to, you know, just perhaps, for the sake of argument, set aside your predisposed prejudice for a moment and say, okay, let me look at this man in a different light. Just try it. First and foremost, the number one thing on Ron Paul's mind when he prepares to vote on a bill, any bill, even one that he himself has authored, is he says, is it authorized under the Constitution? Does Congress have the authority under the Constitution to legislate in this particular instance? And if the answer is no, sir, he simply votes no.
I respect your opinion. I really do. But I have to tell you that if he can't sell his ideas to Congress, I do not see any path to leadership as president.
But what you're stating, think about this now, okay? Let's back up for just a second. Think about this for just a moment. We understand that the president is not the problem. Congress is the problem. Because all those bills are originated in the Congress. All those dealing with that $16 trillion in debt originate in the Congress.
Sure.
So we recognize that this group of people in the House of Representatives is the problem, and the folks in the Senate. And you just told me that if the one honest man out of the 535 can't get the rest of the criminals to go along with his idea, then he's really not a leader. They have no incentive, sir, to go along with doing what's right because they lack integrity. They don't want to give up the easy money that comes with going along to get along. They don't want to give up all the money from the lobbyists and the bankers. And that's why they don't go along with Ron Paul. Because they know if they stood on principled ground like Ron Paul, they'd have to turn their back on that easy money system they've grown so accustomed to.
And this is where the difference is. We've got to have somebody in a position of authority that can make the difference and that can swing that tide and make the difference in Congress. Because as you said, all legislation starts with Congress.
And like I said, if we had 534 Ron Pauls up there, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But we
exactly.
don't.
Exactly.
We've only got one. But explain to me how you have a shining light of honesty and integrity in the Congress, and he's not fit to be president. This is the fundamental problem with our country. This is what got Barack Obama elected to office.
I agree. And our task now is to find somebody who can at least make the appeal to Congress.
To behave themselves.
To actually do something and move forward on the issues. And I think Romney can do that.
I think Romney might be the greatest president we've ever had. If, and only if, your whole purpose for electing a president is to save the status quo, to rescue Congress from themselves and keep the bubble inflating for a while longer.
I think we can do better than that, actually.
Oh, I do too. But unfortunately, the public, the popular vote has spoken, and our chance to do better than that left the building.
Oh, no. I think we can do better with that, with Romney.
Well, you know, Romney certainly, if he gets elected, will have the opportunity to prove me wrong. But if he runs his administration anything like he ran his campaign, I just don't see that being a possibility.
Well, I guess time will tell on that one.
It sure will.
But, hey, great conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope you'll take that to heart. I'm serious. Go back and you know, I mean, you name me another politician, sir, that you can pull up a YouTube clip or pull his record from 1982 and hear him say the exact same thing verbatim that he said in 2002, 2007, 2010. You know, he warned about the housing bubble. He warned about a lot of things. Did you watch the tribute to Dr. Paul from the RNC?
No, I didn't. I have to admit.
I think you should watch that and ask yourself why now all these congressmen are coming out and talking about what a tremendous person and the tremendous character of Ron Paul. Guys like Mitch McConnell and others who wouldn't dare have spoken that until they knew he was safely out of the race. I'm telling you.
Well,
they know he's right. Dick Armey knows he's right. Dick Armey said when he first got to Congress, he thought Ron Paul was absolutely nuts off his rocker. But the longer he was there, and the more he saw the goings on, the more he began to realize that Ron Paul was the only sane one up there. That's a pretty damn good endorsement, I'd say.
Yeah, but he's already said he's not running for office again, so.
Well, I know. His son is, though.
I like his son. His
Everybody
son
loves
a lot more
Rand
sense.
Paul. Well, of course, because he doesn't talk about economics as deeply as his father does. And economics is can be a very confusing subject.
I think the biggest issue is that Rand Paul said that it was okay if Iran gets the bomb.
No,
it was statements
Ron
like
Paul.
that
Ron Paul said that, not Rand. And
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, okay, so I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you believe that the United States of America has a right to tell another country what it can and can't do. Where is that in our Constitution?
I think we have a right to defend ourselves and to...
Right. Has Iran attacked us that I don't know about?
And to take a stand for our allies. I think we absolutely have a right to do that.
I don't think that we have a right to use our military to meddle into the political affairs of other countries. I think that goes against the very idea of America. And it bastardizes and cheapens the Constitution.
And that's why Jefferson sent the Marines to Tripoli.
Jefferson sent the Marines to Tripoli because they were fucking with our shipping. That, sir, is an attack. And if Iran is attacking a U.S. vessel, by all means. But instead of...
Iran has been sending their surrogates into Afghanistan and Iran and killing our troops.
Prove it.
Prove it?
Prove it. What proof do you have? I'm just going to ask you.
They found weapons with Iranian markings on them.
Who found it? Who found it? How do you know they found it? Where did you hear it from, sir? Our government? Well, hell, we know they're the perfect, reliable source, trustworthy, and would never lie to us. Is that what you're telling me? That you
I guess you can find out in any quorum.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that blows my mind with a lot of people, is that they know that the government is full of shit. They know that there's a whole pack of liars up there, including our liar in chief. But, they said that, these evil guys over here in the turbans, they're doing this. Oh, they wouldn't lie to us. It blows my mind. Now, I don't know, and I'll tell you honest, I don't know if our government's telling us the truth about what Iran is doing or not. And quite honestly, I don't care. I've not seen a member of Hamas or Iran in the United States blowing up anything.
Really?
Yeah. You've seen Hamas in the U.S. carrying out terrorist attacks?
They're in Central America.
Well, that's not the United States. I don't give a shit if they're in Cuba. I'm not concerned with Cuba. I'm not concerned with Central America. I'm concerned with the United States of America. And I'm concerned with the government.
Where do you think they're going?
I'm concerned with a government. Well, why wouldn't they want to come here? I mean, my goodness, let's take a look at our intervention in Iran going back to 1953. And let's also take a look at a government, our central government, that leaves our friggin' borders wide open. And you expect that they're not going to try and retaliate, sir? I'm not saying that makes them right. I say we blow the living shit out of them if they try that.
And you're saying it's retaliation.
What would you call it?
I wouldn't call it retaliation.
Okay. So let's put forth a scenario. I'll start with tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, China says it's calling in its debt markers to the United States. And the United States is not able to pay that debt. And China says, well, okay, we're going to take some property within the several states of the United States. And China begins to move troops into the U.S. Would that be okay?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Well, let's say maybe they say, okay, well, I'll tell you what. So we're not going to move troops in. But what we are going to do is we're going to send a group of our secret police into Washington. And right after the election, when Mitt Romney gets elected, he's been pretty hard on us, and we don't like the tone of his rhetoric. So we're going to send our guys in, and we're going to foment a coup to overthrow your president. And they succeed. And then we get some absolute dictator that makes Obama look like Ronald Reagan. And that dictator institutes martial law throughout the country. And he has secret police that come to your house and raid your home. Would you like China then?
Well, you know what? You don't have to imagine that.
Well,
have to do is look at the United Nations Treaty for Small Arms and Agenda 21 and some of Obama's...
Well, hold on a minute. You're right. I don't have to imagine it because that's exactly what we did to Iran in 1953. And that's exactly what led to the Iranian hostage crisis with Jimmy Carter in 1979. And by the way, those Afghan Mujahideen freedom fighters we were funding to fight the Soviets are the same guys that today we call Al-Qaeda. But they have no reason to retaliate against the United States. We're just the biggest damn bully on the block, sir, and we don't know how to mind our own damned business. Now, we can have a philosophical debate as to whether or not the U.S. foreign policy, since World War II, has been a positive or a negative thing for our country. But to argue that when you go pissing in other people's backyards that they're not going to once in a while rise up and try and kick your ass is naive at best. I'm not trying to excuse their actions. But I'm also not going to excuse ours. And the United States of America has no more right to tell Iran what kind of military it can have than my local sheriff has to tell me what kind of frickin' weapons I can have.
Sir, I will tell you this. I was on active duty in 1976, and I served during the Iranian hostage
crisis. Yeah, okay.
People I served with were on those helicopters that crashed.
Okay.
I also served during the time of the Panama invasion and the Black Hawk down.
Yeah. And?
And I also served during Desert Storm 1.
Okay. What was the purpose of any of those operations?
And I can tell you that... friends were lost.
Oh, I don't doubt that, sir. I served in the U.S. Army, field artillery, 1st of the 157th, right out of Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Okay? Don't misunderstand my statements about our government using our military as a political tool, as being anti-patriotic or anti-military. I am not. Our military is to serve one purpose and one purpose only, the defense of this country and the Constitution of the United States of America. And I would suggest to you, sir, that the incursion into Panama and the incursion into the Middle East and our incursion into Vietnam and Korea did not serve that purpose ever.
And there we have a disagreement.
We can. You know, your Congress, your own United States Congress, was sending supplies to the Soviets while we were fighting in Vietnam. Did you know that?
It was a little before my time.
So we knew, I mean, I'm sorry, but we knew damn good and well that everything we were sending to the Soviets was going right to the North Vietnamese and being used against our own troops. Isn't that great?
But the fact is, we've had good and bad in the United States. We've done right, we've done wrong, but we always try to make it better.
Sure. And sometimes we just flat get it wrong. That's what I'm saying. And that's what Ron Paul is saying. And here's the thing I don't understand, okay? You don't believe for a minute that the United Nations has the right to take your guns away, do you?
Not even for a second.
Right. But you certainly believe that the United States has the right to take away the guns of the people of Iran. How does that work? Because that seems to me to be a double standard.
Because they pose a present danger to the United States.
Well, my God, sir, look around the United States at all these people being shot in movie theaters and everywhere else. Gun owners obviously pose that same clear and present danger, sir. That's the very same argument that your government will use against you to take your arms. But you're okay when they use it against someone else as long as it's not you. Think about that. Just think about that. That, sir, is called hypocrisy. It's okay if you do it to him because I don't like him. Oh, maybe we should pass a law that queers can't have guns because I don't particularly like queers, to be honest with you. You see the problem?
That is just so way out there.
Way out there. Way out there. Not sure how it qualifies as way out there. That you don't see any direct correlation to the ideology at all? None?
No, I don't.
So,
national,
you know,
security and our right to bear arms is two different things.
Oh, no, I beg to differ, sir. They are one and the same.
No, they're not.
I thought you had read our Constitution.
How do you define national security and our right to bear arms?
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Necessary to the security of a free state, sir. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It is our national security. That is the whole purpose.
That is a state security.
And the United States is not a nation state, sir.
Oh, you just made the point earlier that...
It was not intended to be. I did not say that it is not currently. It is currently a nation state.
Okay.
But you're trying to make the point. Okay, now, why did the Congress want every state to have a militia? Well, let's go back to that Article 1. They have the right to call forth the militia. To do what? Defend the nation, sir. Dang it.
And how does that play into
the Middle East? Because, sir, what you're advocating is nothing short of hypocrisy. You have every problem in the world with your government disarming you, but you have no problem whatsoever with your government disarming someone else that isn't you. And if you don't see the direct connection there, then I'm afraid that there is no hope.
Okay.
Just because you dislike Iran, okay, and I understand that, I don't particularly care for them either. But I also, just because I don't like them, don't believe that I or my government has the right to go over there and dictate to them what kind of weapons they can and cannot have. They just don't have that authority, sir.
Really, and the fact that they have threatened Israel and they have threatened our country with the possible...
First of all, Iran does not even have the capability to attack the United States from within their borders, sir. Okay? Second of all, if they were intent on destroying Israel, as they say in their rhetoric, they would have done so. They have not.
Uh-huh. And the ships that they have launched and the missiles that they're developing, you don't think they pose any threat to the United States?
Not at all, sir.
Well, I disagree with you on that point.
Well, that's okay. We can disagree on that. But then, you know, you've got this other problem, because when you, if your government used that same ideology on you and I,
mm-hmm.
okay, they're going to say, well, you know, Richard, I know that you're not planning to overthrow the federal government. I know that you and your buddies haven't really talked about it yet, but, you know, you could.
And the Obama administration has done so much.
You're right. They have. I'm telling you, this is the thing. This is the tough part. This is the distasteful part about accepting and upholding the idea of true freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Is that sometimes, as Mark Twain put it, you end up defending a scoundrel, someone that you don't like, someone that you don't agree with, someone that you probably hate or despise. And yet, you must be pragmatic enough in your thinking to recognize that that individual, no matter how much you despise him and everything he stands for, has just the same rights that you have. Because if he does not, then I suggest to you, sir, that you also do not have those rights.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
I would also put this out, that Reagan had said that appeasement is just another form of surrender.
Well, I would ask, why do we continue to send billions of dollars to our allies' enemies if we're truly trying to protect Israel? I mean, if that's the goal, you know, this very same Congress that we keep talking about sends billions of tax dollars to Egypt and Iraq and Afghanistan, and all kinds of Muslim countries. My God, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the World Bank?
Of course I have. But let's go back to this. Why is it acceptable now to present the American people with a form of appeasement, that we must appease our enemies in order to get along?
Well, who's talking about appeasement? I've never heard Dr. Paul mention appeasement, not even once.
He never mentioned it, but that's his tone, that's his rhetoric.
Well, hold on. No. You're not going to get off there. Okay? We're going to stick on topic here. Wait a minute. It's not rhetoric, first and foremost. He wholeheartedly believes in a principle that was stated by George Washington. Okay? So, first of all, it's not rhetoric. Second of all, it is not appeasement. Now, just because you don't understand what the man is saying...
Oh, I understand it.
Well, you don't, or you would not call it appeasement. Nor would you call it isolationism, which I've also heard.
Oh, no, I didn't say that one. But
no, but a lot of them have.
Good point.
A lot of them have, because it's neither of those. You see, everyone seems to miss that one line that Dr. Paul has uttered numerous times. If a situation arises, okay, where the Congress makes a declaration of war, as the president, he has no choice, he has no veto power whatsoever over that declaration. He must fulfill the duties of his office. And as he sees it, the duty of his office as commander-in-chief at that moment in time, that our Congress makes a declaration of war against another country, an enemy, is that we go into that country with every damned thing we have in our arsenal with one goal in mind: destroy the enemy. And once that goal is accomplished, we come back home. Now that, sir, I don't know. Call me wrong, call me crazy. That doesn't sound much like appeasement to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But you see what we've been doing? You've served in several of these theaters. And would you agree or disagree that every single one of those things that you mentioned were A, not a war declared by our Congress, and B, politically motivated?
Well, first I would say that Congress does not need to declare war.
Oh, well, yeah.
In order for the president to take
to
military
use the
action.
Military. Okay, right, because where do we find the authority of the president to do all these covert operations in foreign lands using our military as his own political tool?
He's the commander-in-chief and has the ability
right.
to
he has, for
authorize
a specific,
military action.
Right, for specific purposes, sir. Not for political purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Those specific purposes are to put down an insurrection or a rebellion. Last I checked, Panama, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, you know what? They're not part of the United States of America, so it couldn't possibly be an insurrection or a rebellion. There is another instance where there is what's called a fleeting enemy, meaning we've been attacked and the enemy's going to get away if we don't call up the military right now and get them. Under those circumstances, yes, sir, I agree. The president has all the authority in the world. Outside of that, he has none. That's the problem, you see. That's the fundamental problem with our foreign policy, is that our president is able to use our military as an enforcement arm for the damned United Nations, which is exactly what's been going on. Why were we...
Oh, that's quite a stretch.
Quite a stretch, really. Well, George Bush said that was his authorization. He was enforcing UN resolutions. Did he not? Did he not make that statement? I assure you he did.
He did, but
okay.
I would not back that statement.
Oh, so he was just making that up so it would sound good, right?
No. You're misunderstanding me.
What the hell were we doing in Libya?
I would not make that assertion.
But the president did. Now, either he was lying or he was telling you the truth. I mean, those are really the two options, right?
I was expressing my views, and I don't want my views
confused
with
George Bush.
With those.
Well, again, I mean, you can believe whatever you'd like about what the motivations were for going into Iraq, or what the motivations were for going into Afghanistan, or what the motivations were for going into Libya, or what the motivations are for us being involved in Syria, all of which has absolutely not a damn thing to do with defending the United States of America. We've not been attacked by Syria. Libya didn't attack us. Iraq didn't attack us. I'm still trying to figure out how in the hell this has any of these actions over there has anything to do with defending the United States of America and the Constitution, because they have nothing to do with it.
So you're saying that we should do nothing in Syria?
I'm saying we should not be involved in Syria at all, absolutely 100%. Why should we be involved in Syria?
Oh, I don't know, 20,000 dead.
Are you like, do you have a vested interest in Syrians?
No. I think we all have a vested interest in human life.
Okay. I can go along with that. I still don't think that's a reason to go shed our blood.
I would.
Hey, but you know what? And you're absolutely free to do that. You are free to hop on a plane, fly over there, and volunteer your services. And I don't have a problem with that. And I don't have a problem with you doing that. And I'm not saying that to be a wise guy. If you feel compelled that you need to go and defend the Syrian people from whoever is attacking them and killing all of them, you know, that's your prerogative, sir. And Godspeed, and God bless you for doing it. But we're not talking about you as an individual. We're talking about sending, under orders, thousands of our troops into a foreign theater that we have no business being involved in. Because when we get involved in that, it looks a whole lot like we're trying to uphold the whole United Nations ideology from start to finish. We're doing something that George Washington and the founders warned us against, getting involved in entangling alliances, getting involved in the political and civil wars of other countries. You know, I don't think, now I'm positive, we didn't send our military to France to help them fight in their own internal civil war. I'm certain of that.
Oh, no, we didn't.
Yeah, I wonder why. Yeah, because there were people dying. I mean, good God, they were putting them up on the guillotines.
Oh, yeah.
But we didn't send our troops into France. Why not? Because it was none of our business.
Well, they were fighting for a democracy, not a republic.
Well, I don't care if they were fighting for a damn dictatorship. It was none of our business.
No, it was definitely because they were fighting for just democracy, and at that time, democracy was a bad word.
Sure, but the point remains, there are times.